Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to a Kermode and Mayo special. It's our Films of the Year here on BBC Radio 5 Live. Happy New Year, Mark.
Happy New Year, Simon.
Did you have a nice Christmas?
Lovely Christmas. It was very similar to yours, in fact. We spent some of it together.
That's right. In a strange kind of nether world, because we have to make absolutely clear that it is... What date is it? I can't remember.
It's the 14th of December.
It's the 14th of December at 4:15.
This programme is pre-recorded. Do not text or phone.
Do not email, because we didn't think we'd come in today.
No, we're not here. We're off together in a pub.
That's right. So what we're going to be doing over the next couple of hours is we're going to be looking back over some of the best films of 2009, plus a chance to hear from some of the stars and the odd director or two who we met in the last 12 months. But alongside all the glitter and the glory, there has to be some tears and tantrums. Don't you find that's true, Mark?
That's fantastic, Simon. Are you reading that out?
Now, could you tell? So it only seems appropriate that before we get on to the films of the year, that we should have a countdown of The Good Doctor's top 10 rants. 2009. Has it been a particularly ranty year?
It began badly, didn't it? Because I started with the Bride Wars challenge. The first thing I saw when I came back, I'm sure we'll get to this somewhere, is I saw Bride Wars, the first one back, and I said, this is terrible. If it's not in my bottom 10 films of the year, I quit. I give up. I'm going to stop film criticism if there are 10 films worse than Bride Wars. Well, it's the first of the new year and I'm still here. So there weren't. So actually, it wasn't as bad as I thought. But there was a moment in January 2009 when I thought, I've really had enough of this.
So here we go then. At number 10, it is, and just a reminder, don't get involved. Enjoy the programme, but don't get involved. Thanks. In at number 10, it's the third part of the Underworld series. Now, this one was called Rise of the Lycans, and one of the lead actors was already worried that the Good Doctor wouldn't like it.
At some point, I remember thinking, they're going to review this film that I'm now making. What if Mark and Simon hate it, and I will be so addicted to these podcasts that I'll have to listen to them slagging me off about this film?
And that's the great Michael Sheen, of course. So, were his fears justified?
Underworld, Rise of the Lycans, it's rubbish. I mean, it is just rubbish. Now, on the scale of how rubbish is it, the general feeling from the assembled backpack in screen one of the Trocadero this morning at 12:10 was that it was probably the least rubbish of the Underworld franchise. That doesn't mean it's not rubbish, but it's...
So they're getting better.
Well, yes.
Well, that's good. That's an encouragement. That's, yeah. Michael, well done. You get
terribly boring, but it's less terribly boring, perhaps, than the others. Now, there are the stuff that you need to know about it is, you know, it looks like all those goth movies, vampires, werewolves, rather dodgy CGI because they haven't quite figured out how the werewolves run. Bit at the end that looks like the orc storming the castle in Lord of the Rings, but not as good. But impressively, Michael Sheen does an awful lot of walking around with his chest out, okay? There's one fantastic scene in which he has a sensual moment with his lady love completely, like he was hanging virtually over the edge of a castle cliff. And there's a lot of that going. And there's a lot of sort of Passion of the Christ flagellation and flailing and, you know, all that sort of... So he spends a lot of time with his shirt off. And, you know, it looks pretty good. It looks pretty good with his shirt off, and he spends a lot of time running around in leather trews. Those weird things are the leather trews with the sort of the do-up bit at the front, not like a zip fly or a button fly, but, you know, a bit of string, you know, like goths wear. Never quite understood that, but apparently that's the
homoerotic thing going on, is it?
Well, I think that would be overstretching the word, but he does look good with his shirt off, and he does shout and suffer actually very well. His performance is perfectly fine, but the film's rubbish, and quite boring rubbish at that.
So, you did like Frost Nixon.
Yeah, and it is worth saying that they came out the same week. And what we haven't heard in that particular thing was that I was saying that no matter what else may be wrong with Underworld 3, Lies of the Lycans, was you really have to be impressed by the fact that Michael Sheen, in the same week, could do, you know, David Frost with hello, good evening and welcome. And in screen two, was running around in his leather kecks with his, you know, chest bared to all the world, screaming at the moon. And of course, then he turned up later on in New Moon doing the King of the Vampires. So, I mean, he does have the widest range of any actor working in cinema today.
And he prefers, I think he prefers all that kind of fun fantasy stuff.
Yeah, well, good for him. Good for him. I mean, I'm never anything but knocked out by Michael Sheen. I think it's a real crime that he wasn't Oscar nominated for Frost Nixon or indeed for The Queen. I think he's a fantastic actor and I think he was terrific in Damned United. And, you know, find me somebody else who's as versatile. You know, hilariously, people, there's that quote about Nick Cage, one of the most versatile actors working in cinema. No, every role that Old Horseface does is the same. There's no two roles that Michael Sheen does that are the same.
At number nine, it's Observe and Report.
Oh, dear.
And the film's director and writer, Jodie Hill, and big ideas for the film.
He goes on to say, I think this may be the only comedy ever made that was inspired by Taxi Driver. No, that was King of Comedy, right? Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro made a comedy that was inspired by Taxi Driver, and it was called King of Comedy, and it was dark and edgy, and everything that De Niro did in it. In fact, I think Pupkin is De Niro's finest performance. I think that's the best thing he ever did. And it's that idea of you take the real darkness of Taxi Driver, the, you know, God's lonely man at the heart of that, and you just twist it very slightly. And everyone knows there's a very, very thin line between comedy and tragedy. So, you pea brain, if you're listening, which I'm sure you're not, it's not the first comedy ever to be inspired by Taxi Driver. The guys who made Taxi Driver made a comedy inspired by Taxi Driver. And you know what? It would help if you went back and watched that before trying to remake Paul Blart Mall Cop. I mean, I mention it only in passing, but it's probably one of the finest movies of the decades. And not managing to see it is a crime of unforgivable proportions. Almost as unforgivable as making a film as uncomfortably unfunny as Observe and Report. Now,
yeah, and speaking of not managing to see it,
yes,
an education just pops into my mind there.
Yeah, I really like it. I think she's great. I think the bit when he gets into the car, he doesn't look anything like Mr. Balls, the education thing. I particularly like his purple car, and I thought it was a very interesting film which redefines the you know, the kind of the gender stereotype of the period. Liked it very much, Simon.
So you've seen it?
I have seen it.
You've just spoilt then an entire sequence of this programme. And he does look exactly like Ed Balls.
Can I just say, on the subject of Observe and Report, a lot of people wrote in afterwards, because the stuff was on, you know, listen again, saying, look, they have cited King of Comedy. You can't say they don't know about King of Comedy. They have cited King of Comedy. And I'm sure they have. It just makes the crime of saying it's the first comedy to be inspired by Taxi Driver even worse, because they've seen King of Comedy, they know they're remaking King of Comedy, and then they say that they're doing the first. No, on what level is that better to actually not to know about the thing that proves that the thing you're saying is wrong?
A Couple's Retreat comes in at number eight. I mean, obviously there had to be a Vince Vaughn comedy in here somewhere.
It is like walking into a glass door that doesn't open. It really hurts. It makes your nose kind of, you know, ring and your eyes bloat out. And
why
everybody
does it make your nose ring?
Because it's you know, it's the flat. It's so flat. The whole experience of watching them is so flat, so totally unencumbered by any distinguishing marks like laughter or joy or facial expressions that are recognisable or situations that are in any way believable or funny or comedic or humorous. It is like walking into a glass wall. It just goes boom! And you go, oh, blimey. But when I walked into the glass door of Pizza Hut on Regent Street, right, took about a second. Watching the film took the best part of 2 hours, but the feeling was exactly the same, banging my head repeatedly against a glass door. It hurt and it was unpleasant and horrible.
Have we given up on Vince Vaughn now?
Well, I don't know. I still think that like anyone else, anyone who's done work as good as, for example, Swingers in the past, has some kind of spark in them. I mean, every time you see a film with Vince Vaughn in there, your heart sinks because you know that it's going to be yet another one of those crushing disappointments. But Dodgeball wasn't so long ago, and Dodgeball was for you. You've seen Dodgeball, right?
Well, a long time ago.
Well, it's not that long ago, 4 or 5 years, if that. No, I mean, Dodgeball is funny. Dodgeball is genuinely funny. It is within living memory. So it is entirely possible that Vince Vaughn will do something good. It's entirely possible that Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau together will do something good again. But it's just, if they can make this kind of movie and make that kind of money doing it, why bother to make anything that's any good?
Here comes our first blockbuster into the list. It's fair to say Mark wasn't too impressed with 2012.
In that review of Terminator Salvation, in which Jeff Smith from Radio 1 had liked it, because he said, it's incredible, you know, a helicopter's crashing and a camera goes through the helicopter. You go, yeah, it's CGI, nobody cares, anybody can do that. Nowadays, it's CGI, just go, what can you think of? I can think of a three-headed Hydra coming out of the back of a jet plane, and it doesn't make any difference, I'll just draw it and I'll just do it. So, you don't get any of that thrill that you ever got in disaster movies, of actually watching people do stunts, actually watching things actually happen. You don't get the sense that you did with Live and Let Die. Remember when the car goes up and jumps over the river, and a real car really jumps over a real river. Okay, it's a stunt driver. Okay, it's a stunt car. Okay, they've set it up. Doesn't make any difference. You still went, wow, look at that. A real car really did this. But with this, the planet's falling apart and the buildings are coming down and the airplane's going up. And you're just going, yeah, but you just drew that on the computer and I'm not very interested. Plus, there is a basic rule which goes like this. Any cataclysmic disaster, really genuinely cataclysmic disaster, has after effects that last longer than 17 days. Sorry. That's just how it works, okay? You cannot get over cataclysmic disasters in very short... And you cannot do happy, oh, well, that's all right then. You know, most of the world wiped out, but blimey... So without...
You're not giving too much away.
No, I'm not giving it, because the end of the world movie. End of the world movie. You are paying to see an end of the world movie about the end of the world.
Only with moderate threat.
Made by somebody who saves the dog. Now, you can figure out for yourself, in that case, what happens... In 2012. It is boring, it is bombastic, there is no skill in it, it is demonstration that computer graphics have no weight, it is plodding, it is written by accountants and people who have drawn character arcs from going back through the accounts of previous disaster movies and going, join the dots there, and there, and it is, you know, it is just dull.
See, it's not dull. See, I think that's wrong, because it's stupid and it's too long and it's ridiculous and preposterous. Jason Isaacs has clearly proved that it's not written by accountants. Yes. But it is.
It was written by the Mayans.
It is daft.
Well, there's a couple of things that we should say. Firstly, as many people pointed out, it's not Live and Let Die, it's The Man with the Golden Gun, in which the car turns over. So, mea culpa there. On the subject of CGI, we had a very good text. Somebody wrote and said, excuse me, I work in CGI. If you think anybody can do that, I'd like to see you do it. And which I then subsequently issued a hearty
full retraction.
No, which is this. Of course, CGI is, you know, artful in a way that I couldn't even begin to comprehend or understand. I still think, however, the issue of weight in CGI and the issue of making CGI that's close enough to reality to be credible is one. And that's not to do with the graphic artist problem. That's because that's the fault of the director. The director saying, this is what I want. I want this happening and this happening and this happening. You go do it and then come back and show me. So those things are problems. I still, however, despite the fact that you and Jason have now ganged up on this, oh, it's all Mayan history and it's nothing to do with accountants. Of course it's an accountant's ledger. Of course that's how the movie...
So regardless of the facts, you're just going to stick with your preposterous
theory?
No,
because what I'm saying is you could find, if you go through the Ooga Booga, through the, you know, Erich von Däniken and all that sort of stuff, you could find any calendar year or any year, you could find somebody who said this is when the... Don't you remember every year someone says this is when the world's going to end? It just happens to be that 2012 was coming up and they were getting to, like, you know, 28 or whatever it was, and said, oh, we should start doing this because the sums would add up. You spend the money in 28, 29, you release it comes out, you know, 10, then 11 is the direct cut, and then 12 it's on television. It makes accountancy sense. I'm sorry, it's a simple mathematical formula.
Yeah, it's wrong, but it's a simple mathematical formula.
But actually, the bigger problem is that you actually quite enjoyed 2012, didn't you?
Well, because my expectation had been reduced to such a low level.
By me?
Yeah, right. By you, that I went to the store. Oh, it's all right. Yeah.
Did you see it on your own?
No.
Did you? So did
en
you
famille.
You saw en famille. And how did famille feel about it?
Oh, they thought it was quite fun and a bit stupid most of the time.
Okay. All right. Quite fun and a bit stupid. And you went in with terribly low expectations and thought it was all right.
Yeah.
It's not a ringing endorsement, is it?
At six, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which attracted quite a lot of Oscar hype, as you might remember. But Mark soon got rid of all of that.
Let us say, in defence of Benjamin Button, that it is well directed, in as much as it's quite nicely lit. And the special effects are quite good. You do think, I wonder how they managed to get Brad Pitt to look like an old man who actually looks like a six-month-old baby. That is quite clever. Must have been digitally complicated. Beyond that, it's a whole bunch of hooey. Now, two things. Firstly, I had to take...
Just going to write that down. So this is for the poster,
yes,
isn't it?
It's a whole bunch of hooey. Because life is like a box of chocolates. I had to take two runs
at
it.
What is hooey?
Hooey?
Yes.
It's like blather. It's like baloney.
Yes. I mean, I know what it kind of means. I just wonder what it is.
In real life?
Yes.
I don't know. Somebody can Twitter and tell us. Is there a dictionary definition of hooey?
Okay? I'm sure it'll happen very quickly.
The problem with it is manifold. Firstly, it's all over the place. I mean, narratively, I mean, even to use the word narratively is kind of, you know, I kept complaining about the death of narrative cinema. You can say something's episodic. You can say that something is picaresque. You can say that something has got a lot of, you know, sequences. That, but it is one of those things where it goes, starts, you know, end of a big war, ends up present day, Hurricane Katrina, all these kind of major events happen in the middle. To what effect? Well, honestly, none. They just happen to be there in the background to give it a sense that something profound must be happening. I mean, at one point, he's in an old people's home, then he's in a brothel, then he's on a street, then he's in a boat, then he's fighting World War II, then he's doing something else. You're going, yes, where is he going? Why is he going there? And when he gets there, is there actually going to be any point in it? The answer to all the above is dunno, don't care, and no.
Don't text in about hooey because this is a pre-recorded item.
Did anybody text in when we first did that and say what hooey meant?
I just looked it up again. It means nonsense and foolishness of unknown origin, and first turned up in 1924.
Oh, fantastic! And is that in the Oxford English Dictionary?
The Online Etymology Dictionary.
Great. So it does it. It is a proper word. It's not a
proper word. It just means nonsense.
Right. Hooey. And can you look up flimflam?
Well, no,
and flibbity gibbet.
No, because
and lackadaisical.
No, I really don't. I really don't think so.
I think those words should be used more often, though.
We are halfway through Dr. Kermode's top 10 rants here on BBC Radio 5 Live. It's getting a little bit nasty now. Only one man could be mean when you think about it. About fluffy blonde Owen Wilson, lovely glossy Jennifer Aniston, and a cute Labrador. What's not to like? Answer: Marley and Me. It's in at number 5.
Marley and Me just does the rank little, you know, oh, cute, 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 poopy, 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 cute, 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 ah, okay. You know, hey.
What was that bit?
It's the bit at the end.
Oh,
it's the bit at the end, which is the most unjustified, you know, terminal scene that I have seen in a very long time.
Ooh,
it was yucky and then some. And it was made all the worse by the fact that all the way through it, I had to put up with Owen Wilson and Jennifer Aniston going on a life journey and experiencing things together in a way that made them grow.
Don't do that voice
in a way
again.
They never knew they could be together until Marley showed them that there's more to life than just being really annoying people.
But not as annoying as that voice. Owen, on this text...
I've become possessed by the devil.
I've thought that for a while, actually.
I know you have.
Marley and Me and Orson Welles.
Actually, that would be a good movie.
That would work, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I was taken to task about this because I said, you know, Marley and Me is a horrible film and it is less fun than having an animal put down. And, you know, if you why get Marley and Me? Why not just actually get a dog? And somebody came up to me...
And have it put down.
No, somebody came up to me in the street and said, actually, I can't have a dog in my flat, so can I have Marley and Me? I thought, well, you know, very well argued, fair enough. But I do not understand the motivation behind getting Marley and Me on DVD at all. If you want to get a, you know, fun film about a dog, get Digby, the biggest dog in the world.
Or Beethoven, that was quite...
Beethoven was great. Even Beethoven 2 was perfectly decent. Beethoven was fine, though.
He was left unconvinced by Meg Ryan as a helicopter pilot. Ladies and gentlemen, what would Dr. K think of a film that presented the audience with Kate Hudson as a high-powered lawyer? At number 4, here it is, it's Where Our Journey Started, Bride Wars.
There are two Anne Hathaway movies at the moment which are, you know, Anne Hathaway nuptial projects. One of them is Rachel Getting Married, which is directed by Jonathan Demme, which is this kind of edgy, handheld affair about these really horrible people who, you know, you're meant to kind of empathise with, but you don't. And but it's for your consideration. And then we have this, which is this not edgy, not handheld movie about horrible people who you're meant to find funny, but you don't, which is for your money. And the story is Anne Hathaway and Kate Hudson are two close friends, and they've grown up together with dreams of weddings. Ever since they were little girls, they dreamt about weddings. And now they're both going out with boys who are both going to propose to them, and they're going to have weddings. But you never guess what. They both dream of having the same wedding, and the coincidence, on the same day and in the same place. That's going to create a clash of loyalties. Here's a clip.
At the end of the day, I want you at my wedding, and whichever way this works out, one of us will just have to be married on a different day.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I want you at my wedding, too, obviously. If we can't think of any other way out of this, one of us will simply have to be flexible.
Yeah, one of us will just have to change venues.
Right, one of us could. Probably not the one of us who's been saving up for a decade because she makes a pittance compared to the other one of us, but...
True. I mean, or it would be if the other one of us wasn't so desperate to get married to the Plaza because the Plaza practically is the only happy memory she has of her childhood. So, oops, that's... Right.
One of us will have to move her date.
Yep, one of us will.
And until one of us decides, we shouldn't make any concrete plans.
Agreed. There's some time before we lock things in. Let's just not do anything.
Right.
Until one of us moves her date.
Okay, so, talk to you soon. One of us should call the other one.
Did you deliberately choose the worst clip from the movie? Then?
No, that's the one. That's the clip. Do you hear the music in the background? Bucky, 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 funny, jolly, ha, 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 ha. Now, everyone will tell you it's a chick flick. Only in the sense that if you ground it up and fed it to battery hens, it might be better served than running it through a projector.
I know quite
cinema.
A few battery hens who want to go and see this film. What am I saying?
You see, the great thing about what you do for us all is that you go see these films so we don't have to.
I know.
I feel as though we've experienced these movies without actually ever going to see them.
Although there's a terrible,
so thank you.
There's a terrible thing that there is somebody in my family who has watched Bride Wars 5 times and thinks it's one of the funniest films of the year and can't understand why on earth I have this objection to it. So it
was is that the good lady wife?
No, it's not.
Is it the good daughter?
Yes. It was on a plane, literally 5 times, with just laugh-out-loud hilarity all the way through.
Now, you might realise we've got to the top three, and you may well be writing in at this point, or calling, or texting, which would be inappropriate because we're not here, saying there's been no Dan Brown yet.
Yes, but that's because he's gone straight in
at number three with his Angels and Demons.
The first hour is as boring as ever, even though they're doing the running and explaining with the less bad haircut. The little bit after that, snore-inducingly bad. But the last 40 minutes are laugh-out-loud funny, and I guarantee if Gerry Anderson had come up with that plot for Thunderbirds or something, he would have torn the place up. The skydiving implications of it are so staggering. I mean, I don't want to give away. It's in a way, I want to tell you what happens in the end because the end is so funny.
No, well, you can't.
But the end is so funny. When you go and see the film, and people will go and see the film, people will see it in their droves.
I will go and see the film.
Tell me if you don't laugh at the revelation moment. I mean, I sat there and I was genuine. It was like that Monty Python thing about as if you've been hit by a wet fish. The great revelation, let there be light, I've got a helicopter pilot's license, it's all coming together, and the clock's ticking moment was staggering. A couple of other things to point out. I love to see Armin Mullerstahl in these films, because whenever they want somebody who's non-specifically European, get Armin Mullerstahl. Nobody knows where he's from. He just talks in a voice that's vaguely European. Let's get him. Is he busy? No, let's get him in. Also, only Ron Howard could have directed the following two sequences as action sequences. Firstly, a trip to the Vatican Library, which turns into a nail-biting action sequence, only without the nail-biting. And secondly, the announcement of a new pope. You know how they announce a new pope? Smoke up the chimney?
Yes, why?
Ron does the smoke going up the chimney as an action sequence. It's Mission Impossible goes to the Vatican with some Star Trek and Thunderbirds thrown in for good measure. It is stupid in ways that you could not possibly imagine.
But you know what? Listening back to that, I realise I've let you down.
Because you didn't go and see
it. I never ever went to see it.
Why didn't you?
Because so many people
actually were
coming to the same conclusion and saying, you know what, the ending, that's just utterly stupid.
What's the embargo on giving away the ending? How does that, because I said at the time I didn't want to give away the ending, but now we're at the end of the year, the book's out, the film's out, the DVD's out. Am I allowed to now discuss what it is that happens at the end that is so fantastically stupid? Because you've got into trouble with this when you did your...
The thing is, if you gave away the end of the Ten Commandments, people would probably get upset.
What do you mean the end of the Ten Commandments?
Well, the movie.
Oh, sorry, I thought you meant the Tenth Commandment. That's when they eat cheese or something.
I got into trouble, I mean, in an interview with George Clooney about Perfect Storm.
Yes.
We got into trouble because in the course of that interview made reference to the fact that everybody dies.
But it's a historical thing. Everybody did die in the real world. You can't pretend. That's like, I went to see Apollo 13 with Wendy Lloyd from Radio 1, who was obviously half my age. And I thought what was really clever about that film was that they managed to inject tension into it. I mean, this is a Ron Howard connection. Despite the fact that everyone knows that Apollo 13 arrived safely back on Earth. And at the end of it, Wendy Lloyd turned to me and said, that was really exciting. I had no idea how that story ended. Because, of course, you know, she wasn't...
So to answer your question, I don't know... why don't you describe a little bit of the end?
OK. Ewan McGregor, Begorra, runs out of the Vatican with the antimatter. And then...
And what does that look like? What's it in?
It's in a tube, isn't it? It's in a glowing tube.
Like I said, I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it. And
is it glowing just so you let you know it's...
Yeah, because it's being held in an electrical force field, the battery of which is running out. There's a timer that's letting the electrical force field run down. And then he runs out into the square. He jumps into the helicopter. I've got a pilot's license. He flies up above...
I think you need to just stop there because there'll be some people who haven't got to that bit on the DVD.
Okay. Fiat Lux is what then happens.
Let there be light.
Let there be light. As opposed to Vauxhall Vectra or whatever it is. Yes. Fiat Lux.
Is that sufficiently up in the air?
That is sufficiently up in the air, in both literal and metaphorical terms.
What you have to do now is to keep listening to find out which two films irritated Mark the most in 2009. You might have guessed what they are. The results coming up shortly. This is Kermode and May. Let's try Mayo and Kermode's Films of the Year on BBC Radio 5 Live. Which films irritated the good doctor so much that they put all the others into the shade? Here we are at number two, and it's Terminator Salvation, which gave us this splendid one-note performance from Christian Bale as John Connor.
This is John Connor. If you're listening to this, you are the Resistance.
Listen carefully. If we attack tonight, our humanity is lost.
Command wants us to fight like machines. They want us to make cold, calculated decisions. But we are not machines. And if we behave like them, then what is the point in winning?
Command is going to ask you to attack Skynet.
I am asking you not to. If even one bomb drops on Skynet before sunrise, our future will be lost.
So please, stand down. Give me the time to protect our future that all of us are fighting for.
This is John Connor.
This is John Connor. In a world where I have to speak like this for the whole film.
But we should know it's not just for the whole film. It was for the outburst, of course, because the thing that Terminator Salvation is most famous for is that he had an outburst on set when they were shooting a scene and the cameraman started moving some lights around and Christian Bale went off on one. And this was recorded and it was then, you know, put up on the net and everybody heard it. And he went and he was shouting at this guy, "Don't you dare! Don't you dare move the thing on my... Don't you dare!" Using sort of rather more explicit language than that. But he did it in character. Because the thing that nobody, people didn't concentrate on was the fact that he did it in an American accent, in the accent of the character that he was playing. So even when he was throwing the biggest wobbly hissy fit that anyone heard all year, he did it in character. And I think hats off to him. Because the fact of the matter is, the poor guy suddenly realised he was in a film directed by McGee.
Well, you see, now we get to it. So the voice was half the issue. The rest of it was the film's director.
It was.
Tell us about him again.
It was McGee.
Thank you.
I think everyone thinks that in Dark Knight, the Batman voice was a problem. Because in Dark Knight, they had made the decision that somehow when he was being Bruce Wayne, he talked like, you know, Christian Bale with an American accent. But when he was being Batman, he talked like that. He talked like, you know, somebody...
It was almost Yorkshire.
It was. That's where he came from. But in this, there's a really weird thing that he's obviously gone into character and he's decided that the character of John Connor will just deliver every line in that voice. And I was thinking about this. I was thinking, why would Christian Bale be in a Terminator when he himself has said... Nobody thinks that Terminator 3 is the best Terminator movie, so why do we need another one? I don't want to be in just an action movie. And, of course, the film is directed by McGee. McGee, who's famous for directing the two Charlie's Angels movies. And he's famous for having said in the paper... I brought this in just to prove I'm not making it up. Said in the paper over the weekend, this is McGee...
This will be a Guardian supplement, of course, yeah. Which will surprise nobody.
No, but I just saw, you know, I'm not making it up. I was headbutted by Bill Murray. I mean, that, in a way, is the review of the film, right? McGee is a director who's headbutted by Bill Murray. I mean, I can't imagine a circumstance under which you could actually get Bill Murray to headbutt somebody, but McGee managed to do it. Now, McGee's entire...
Can you stop that now?
No, I can't, because that's his name.
Yes,
okay?
We'll just say it
no, and he has said, one of the reasons people don't like me is because I'm called McGee. You go, no, you know what? There are so many reasons not to like you, and the fact that you're called McGee is actually the least of them. The reason people don't like you is you can't make films. Right, Charlie's Angels and Charlie's Angels Full Throttle are like, let's play dress up and you can all watch and everything's got to cut every other second because there's no substance to it. And in fact, I'm an advertising commercials television director who just happens to have landed on a movie set and been given this great big dressing up box to throw at the cinema screen. And I remember sitting there watching Charlie's Angels and starting to get some mild palpitations, irritated. This was the way cinema was going. In the middle of Terminator Salvation, the only two things that kept me going through it, because it's so crushingly dull. I mean, it's explosions and crashes and hitting and shooting and hitting and shooting and shouting and explosions and crashes and hitting and shooting, and it just goes on and on and on. And the only two things that kept me sane were, why did Christian Bale do it, right? The money? Does he need it? He just did Dark Knight, which is one of the biggest selling movies of all time. And secondly, why on earth is it that anyone would sign up to a movie that was directed by Mitchie when it is clear from his past track record that, one, he can't direct films, two, his sets descend into, outright aggression, three, the script wasn't the script that he wanted to do in the first place because it was just an action movie and he wasn't sure which character he wanted to do, and four, that it was entirely the kind of situation in which he was suddenly going to walk on set one day. And here's what I think happened with the lighting thing, right? I think Christian Bale was on set and somebody moved a light in the room, and he just suddenly went, "I've woken up. I'm in a movie directed by McGee. I'm in Charlie's Angels 3. One minute I was considered to be one of the great acting talents of the generation. I've suddenly, it's like that thing you wake up naked in your maths exam. You know, everyone has that, right? Maybe not you, maybe just me. But everyone else has some, dream, and you suddenly wake up, how did I get here? And I think that's what happened. I think Christian Bale literally woke up on set one day and went, I'm being directed by McGee. And that the knowledge of thinking, because I guarantee he knows not only that the film is rubbish, but that he is absolutely rubbish in it. And the only thing that kept me, that held my attention...
Is this the fifth point, or is it still on four?
The end, was looking at the face of Christian Bale and thinking, around the explosions and all the rest of it, I can see that look of absolute panic when somebody realises they're doing something that they really shouldn't be doing. A final point. The film is directed...
This
is the final point. Dedicated to the memory of Stan Winston. If you want to honour the memory of Stan Winston, go and hire Vengeance the Demon, a.k.a. Pumpkinhead, on DVD. You do not need to trouble yourself with furthering the career of McGee.
Why did you do it in that stupid voice?
Because that's how you say it.
Well, that's how no one else says it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's how everybody says it. What's it? McGee. McGee. Because it's a stupid... I speak as a guy who's, as everybody points out, his name is, essentially that of a toilet. But McGee clearly has got a proper name. Somewhere in the world he has a proper name. But he chooses to call himself McGee. And he said, people hate me because of my name. No, there's so many other reasons.
Like your work.
Like your work, exactly.
Okay, so we've counted out all the way to number one. Here we go. And this, you may well remember, had the added advantage of being done in front of a live audience in Edinburgh's Cineworld, and they had to wait until the final 10 minutes of the programme to hear Mark's review of Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen. When it came, it was kind of worth it.
Hello? Michaela.
I can't believe you're going to stand me up on our first web chat date.
I just had a full-blown mental meltdown. I am seeing symbols ever since I...
Since what?
Ever since I touched the cube splitter. Do you have it?
Yeah, I have it. It's in the shop safe. It's fine.
Michaela, do not touch it, okay? Don't touch it.
I'm not going to touch it. Sam, it's fine. It's locked away. No one knows where it is.
I do.
That's it, okay. That's about as much sense as it's going to make.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Very early on in the film...
Are you twittering?
I just took a photograph of you and put it up, yeah.
Thank you.
You plus the Five Live hoarding.
Okay.
Very early on, the woman...
Yes, because you saw the first hour.
Yeah. The woman, what's her name?
Megan Fox.
Is draped...
No, sorry, can I just say Megan Fox?
Exactly. A real treat.
Megan Fox.
I would say, while Mark was saying that, he bent seductively over the leatherette armchair. So why is it that... Megan Fox. When we see it,
Megan Fox.
is bent over a motorcycle in very short shorts. What is that about?
Well, this is, I mean, this is, I have to say, essentially at the kind of the heart of my problem with the whole Transformers thing. Because, look, okay, originally Transformers, as you know, it's a toy. Here's the thing. Here's the plot of the toy. Car turns into a robot, turns back into a car. Okay? So there is a Transformers movie. You know, there's cartoon Transformers. I mean, it's a kid's toy, and I have no problem with that sort of thing. That's absolutely fine. And then what happens is they decide to update Transformers. And they say, okay, let's make a huge, big, enormous Transformers movie. And therefore, what we're going to have to do is we have to maximize the audience that's going to. Now, essentially, as everybody understands, Transformers audience is, you know, young boys who want to watch robots hitting each other. That's absolutely fine. It's a kid's toy product thing, okay? But in order to make the sums add up for the new Transformers movie, what they have to do is to say, okay, well, let's add an element of stuff that will attract the teenage audience. And effectively, what Michael Bay has done, I've said this before, Michael Bay is a filmmaker with a pornographic sensibility. I mean, everything about the way the Michael Bay film looks, he's like, whoa, hey, whoa, look, car, whoa, look at that car, whoa, that robot, whoa, that engine, whoa, hey, hey, whoa, that Megan Fox, hey, whoa.
Is he from Croydon?
Pardon?
Is he from Croydon?
Everyone who says that is from Croydon, fine. So that is essentially his filmmaking sensibility, and that's how he's done it. So what they've done is they've said, okay, so we'll make the Transformers movie entirely like that, with the whole look of the film, the whole sound of the film, everything about it will just be, hey, whoa, robots, whoa, car, whoa. Now, to some extent, I can kind of tolerate 90 minutes of people going, what about robots hitting each other? What bothers me, and it bothered me in the first Transformers movie, and it bothers me even more, and this may just be to do with, you know, rampant political correctness on my part, I don't know whether I missed a meeting or at exactly what point it became completely acceptable to make a movie that's essentially aimed at young kids that has such a leery quality to it in terms of its the way that it looks at the female characters. I mean, I'd say female characters. I mean, I think even using the word characters is overstating the way they're used. When we were introduced to Megan Fox, as Simon quite rightly says, she is, you know, draped over a motorcycle. The bit that you miss is then that the rest of the movie has exactly the same aesthetic. There is one moment in which Shia LaBeouf, Sleepy LaBeef, Snoozy LaPork, goes to college, where his college incidentally appears to be entirely peopled by the population of Maxim magazine. And immediately he is pursued by a young woman in a short skirt, whose short skirt the camera follows in a paparazzi-like fashion. And Michael Bay actually makes a plot point of doing this. I don't want to spoil the surprise if anybody actually wants to go and see this, but it's almost like there is a science fiction plot point for the leery way in which the camera follows this, you know, this. What I say, you know, she's meant to be a college student, but obviously she's actually a 35-year-old pole dancer, probably. And so what bothers
me... She's not 35.
Whatever, not Megan Fox. So what bothers me is that you can no longer just make a stupid action movie with robots hitting each other, which I have no problem with at all. That's absolutely fine. What you do is you crank it up to get as far as you can get within the certificate that kind of that will give you the biggest possible audience. And somehow it has become acceptable for that kind of movie to have the most leery, the most absolutely Neanderthal, the most, I think, reprehensible and rather sad attitude to the way that it looks at those characters. And you see this, I mean, Michael Bay has produced a number of horror movie remakes in which this very same quality is evident. So I want to be absolutely clear. Yes, the film is mind-bendingly terrible. It is incredibly long and incredibly loud and incredibly boring, and nothing happens very loudly about 100 times. Okay, so all those things aside, and the because of the way that the robots are now animated, to be honest, you neither know nor care which bit of robotry is hitting which other bit of robotry, and there's some weird sort of backstory about why the Transformers are back, because as we know, we thought they'd gone away, but essentially it is robots turn into cars, turn into robots, start hitting each other with added war all the way through. And I'm sorry, but I have now got to the point that I have lost patience with this. And I think it's not enough to just say this is rubbish and it's not. It's actually time to say no, enough is enough. We really cannot just embrace a world in which this is now being given to us as essentially middle of the road, multiplex fare. It's not good enough. It really isn't good enough. And I'm quite serious when I say this. It's not just that it's a bad film. It's that it's a film with a rotten heart. The only thing that's at its heart is a big ringing cash till, and it is like seeing somebody just getting a towel which has been sort of with money in and just squeezing the money, and literally you can hear the cash registers. They go, okay, we're hitting all the points, we're doing all this stuff, we're doing as far as we can get away with, in a way which has no artistry, no invention, no wit, no nothing at all. It is just there to milk the money out of the largest possible audience in the most cynical, most dreary, most boring possible way. I hated it.
So you actually got a round of applause. See, that's the great thing about doing it in front of a live audience.
Yes.
When you do something long and you flap your big windy hands that much, people applaud. It's a great moment.
Yeah, I don't. It's a really funny thing because when I started out doing criticism, I never thought of it as being an on-stage thing, as being a performance thing. But it was funny that the Transformers thing. It did feel like it. It built to a crescendo of event. But I hated that film. I really,
really,
really yeah, no, no.
Oh,
no.
I see.
But did you see it?
Well, if you remember, I saw about the first 40 minutes and then had to
leave. Yeah, you didn't even get as far as John Turturro in his pants, did
no.
you?
Though I did then have to interview John
Turturro and say that I saw 40 minutes of the movie, but you hadn't got as far as
exactly.
that. Can I say, incidentally, for the record, I've seen that film twice, from beginning to end, twice. Because I have this policy of just because I think it's something doesn't mean anybody else should think it. So if certain members of my family decide that they want to be taken to see these things, I take them along. So I sat through Transformers 2 Revenge of the Fallen twice.
Which member of your family asked to go to that then?
Well, you know, the man-child. And he thought it was great, but he didn't understand what useful purpose was served by Megan Fox.
So was Transformers... Yeah, fortunately you don't waggle your backside in the air anymore when you do that. Was Transformers the worst film you saw in 2009?
I think all things considered, it probably was because of the gargantuan expense and just the horror of just how bad it was. And the fact that Michael Bay most recently seen, incidentally, directing adverts for Victoria's Secret. There's a surprise. Because he does have that strange mixture of, you know, explosions and pornographic sensibility.
Just one more thing to ask you before we move on to happier territory.
Because, yeah, because there are films that I've liked. This yes. has given the impression that I've done nothing but been cross.
I know. Well, we'll get there. Cast your mind back to Bride Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the first film, actually the
first film
that you reviewed in
2009. First film that I saw, yeah.
And this is what you said at the time.
This was the first film back of 2009 for me. And it was one of those things when you go, it's the first film I've seen in 2009, and I'm already fast-forwarding to the end of 2009 and thinking, if this is not in my top 10 worst of the year, top 5 worst of the year, then the year will have been so bad that I make you this promise now. If Bride Wars isn't in my top 10 worst films of the year, if there are 10 films worse than Bride Wars this year, I quit. Okay?
Which is a stupid thing to say anyway, but...
No, it wasn't, because I was quite depressed by it. But I'm quite thrilled now that there weren't 10 films worse than Bride Wars. Although, you know, thank you very much to all the people who texted and emailed in suggestions of films that I ought to take into consideration, which led me to believe that perhaps people wanted me to go. I mean, there were things like Dance Flick. There were things like Transformers 2. There were things like the Charles Dickens England, which wasn't even a movie, but somehow managed to get it. Those things were worse, and Miss March, but there weren't 10 films worse than Bride Wars, and I'm thrilled by that.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Mayo and Kermode's Films of the Year.
It's our Films of the Year. Well, though obviously it's last year, because here we are in the new year. So we're marking,
oh, it is. Yes, it is the new year, isn't
it? We're marking the new year here on 5 Live by talking about last year.
Last year.
I suppose it kind of works because it's a Friday, but it's a bit strange. Anyway, so you'll have to hang on to find out what, in Mark's opinion, and of course that is the only opinion that counts.
Other opinions are available.
Were the best films of 2009, because there is some positive stuff. Some honourable mentions for films, just to give a little positivity at this point. They haven't actually made the top 10,
yeah,
but they made 2009 worth thinking about.
Well, I really like Me and Orson Welles. I liked it very much. Again, I saw that a couple of times. I thought it was terrific central performance by Christian Mackay, who does the best screen Welles I've seen. I love the fact that they filmed it in the Gaiety Theatre in the Isle of Man, because it was one of those cases of a film being made in that location for the right reasons. You know, not simply a financial thing. It was, the location was right. And I thought it was a much better film than perhaps people had expected. I liked the idea that people would go along and see it and be introduced to Orson Welles, who actually, you know, up until that point only knew Zac Efron. It does prove also that Zac Efron is a perfectly decent actor, but Christian Mackay is the standout performance there. We talk quite a lot about Up, And the question of whether or not Up was a, you know, was a masterwork. I remember having all the conversations about WALL-E being a best film contender. And I personally, I still don't think Up was quite was quite on the same level. But there are things in Up, specifically the first 5 to 7 minutes, the sort of the montage sequence in which we see the main character growing up, falling in love, you know, meeting his wife, losing. I mean, I think that stuff is absolutely heartbreaking, and it's brilliantly done.
And there were many emails from listeners who said one of the reasons they were glad it was in 3D was because they had the glasses on.
Yeah.
And it kind of covered up the fact that they were piping their eye. They were blubbing like a child.
But that's lovely. I don't think you need 3D glasses to cover up, you know, good tears. I mean, I think crying in the cinema is a great thing. I think we should all embrace it a little bit more.
That's because you do it all the time.
No, but you're telling me that this year you didn't cry in
Correct.
Any films? Didn't in any films at all?
No.
Really?
No.
Not at all?
No. Do you want to try that again?
Did you cry in any films at all?
Still no.
No.
Okay. However many times you ask me that question,
okay, all right,
I still haven't done
Did you cry in Avatar?
No.
Well, you know, some people would have done. We should mention Avatar here because this is, again, we're talking about films, you know, worthy of mention that didn't make the top 10. Now, I have to say that I went into Avatar with fairly low expectations because I really, really don't like Titanic. And I think, as we discussed, I think there's a load of stuff wrong with Avatar. I think it's baggy. I think it's overly long. I think I never quite relaxed into the fact that the blue creatures, you know, because you'd said Smurfahontas before I went in.
Smurfahontas is still good.
Yeah, it is.
Dances with Wolves in Space is still good.
Yeah, but it's a problem in exactly the same way as when somebody said, when David Cox said to me, you know, Forrest Gump on a tractor just before I watched The Straight Story, I couldn't get Smurfahontas out of my head. But I think, and I think you agreed with me about this, that there are things in Avatar that are really impressive. There are, you know, spectacular vistas and, you know, huge, great big CGI landscapes, which really, you know, are, you know, really quite, you know, awe-inspiring. And I think the way...
A couple of moments where you think, that's a Yes album cover.
Yeah. Oh, well, the whole thing looks like a Yes album cover. Again, as we discussed in some length, the whole thing, you do keep expecting, you know, the sound of John Anderson's warbling voice to come over, because it is clearly... It was, what's he called? Roger Dean.
Roger Dean.
Roger
absolutely.
Dean.
Roger Dean Ahoy is what it you is, have to yes, shout out absolutely. When you see the floating mountains.
It is Roger Dean Ahoy, and it is Fern Gully, and, you know, there's no getting around that. But there are things in it that are just, in terms of, you know, digital animation, are really quite astonishing. But I do think it proves absolutely, incontrovertibly, we were all waiting for it to demonstrate to us that immersive 3D was the future. No, it's not. The future is flat. What Avatar demonstrates is that is the pinnacle. And you know what? No, it's fine. Because there were, as I said before, there were moments when I took the glasses off and I just had a look at the blurry out of focus screen because I was watching it without 3D and it worked perfectly well. You know, and I just wanted to be watching it in flat screen. Flat screen IMAX would be great.
Yeah, I think, and again, we said this earlier, although we actually haven't said that yet.
Oh, don't.
Which is really, you know, which is a strange thing. I think the 3D is better than that. After about the first 20 minutes of thinking, this is, this doesn't feel good because it feels like I'm just watching a computer game. But then once you get to the planet in question, I think you do feel as though you're there. I think it's a very immersive thing. But I don't disagree with your conclusion. The future is 2D. But for this particular project, I think it's his Star Wars.
I think it is his Star Wars. I think it's much better than the Star Wars prequels. But I think that if you'd seen that spectacle in 2D on a good, you know, well-projected image in 2D, it'd be perfectly fine. You know, it's like there are moments when it is the pointy birds are pointy-pointy in which people point spears out at you. And there are moments when people jump off cliffs and fall down into ravines in which you think, oh, I'm getting that vertiginous thing. And is that being enhanced by 3D? But no, I've seen scenes like that in IMAX or in, you know, a well-projected movie. I mean, you saw The Dark Knight in IMAX. Didn't need to be in 3D. You just saw it in IMAX, the bit when he jumps off the building. That works. It flat screen is the future. The 3D thing is a gimmick. Everyone knows it. It's just an industrial, you know, way of attempting to say, oh yeah, this is something you can only get in the cinema. And no. Avatar, all the things that are right with Avatar are nothing to do with 3D.
But it's still a good film.
It's a much better film than it could have been. I mean,
is it a good film?
No, it's still flawed in ways that are bothersome.
It can be good and flawed.
You know, it is very flawed. There are things
in
it.
It can be good and very flawed.
Yes, there are things in it that are good. It isn't good, but there are things in it that are good. But it is, I mean, you know, it is way too long, and it has the James Cameron issue of he has to say everything three times. I mean, he is the guy who directed the scene in Titanic when the boat is going, you know, end up, and Leonardo DiCaprio turns to Kate Winslet and says, "This is where we met." And you go, "I know! I know because I saw it like about an hour and a half. I know that's where you don't have to say it out loud, you pea brain."
See, I quite like Titanic.
Yeah, I know.
When I went in to see the film, I was thinking, I'm going to enjoy this because I enjoy Titanic, but I think Mark might struggle.
No, but I struggled a lot less than you thought. And there were many moments in it that you thought I was going to really hate. And actually, I was quite swept along with many moments in it. I thought just on a level of spectacle, it was spectacular. It was spectacular.
And good?
No, there are things in it that are good. It is not good, but there are things in it that are good, and there was more goodness in it than I had expected.
So what you've had is some positive comments.
Positive comments.
Which have been brought about by the movies that were pretty good.
Pretty good.
But they weren't good enough to make the top 10. So coming next, that top 10 and also some of our favourite interviews of 2009.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.